If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Marcia Bennett Mayo is a UK-based stonemason and textile artist whose iconic images explore her position as a black woman in the modern world. This is the second part of our Needle Exchange, and in this we have a wide-ranging conversation that talks about stonemasonry, as you would expect on a textile podcast. But if you know me, you know I like to find out about stuff I don't know about. So we talk about Marcia's experiences as a stonemason. We also talk about black history and how it is expressed through art, and how she has chosen to focus on certain figures within black history for some of her art pieces. We talk about how she explores food within textile art. And obviously we have our familiar touch points about your favourite books, the kind of music that she listens to when she's working, something that is indeed quite influential on her work. Marcia's great. I love talking to her. I enjoyed the first part of our conversation. If you haven't heard that, go and get the previous episode, episode number 49. Also, just as an aside, yay, episode 50. Congratulations, everyone. Thanks for being here. Marcia, just so lovely to talk about. So considered in what she says, so elegant in the way she delivers her work. She's able to talk about black history through her art in a way that makes it accessible and palatable to people. It was just a joy. I could have talked to her for another hour and a half. This is one of the longest needle exchanges I've had, this two-parter, and I think you'll understand why, because we've got so much to talk about. She's also got a fantastic interest, in fact, that not a lot of people know about her as well. Right at the end of the show, so be sure to listen to that. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you enjoyed the first part of the show. Please do leave a review on your favourite podcasting platform if this has floated your boat. And I'll be back next week with another conversation with a different artist. So thanks for being here. Thanks for joining me for 50 episodes. I'll see you episode 51. In the meantime, enjoy the show. When you're doing the historical stuff, do you have a particular intention in mind? Are there certain characters you think I really want to focus on that? How do you choose who to do next, as it were?
It's really a case of what comes under my radar. The Motorcycle Queen, she's been bubbling for a year or so. Because I do have a file of imagery on my laptop of black women from history. So she's been bubbling. She was there for a good long while. I don't know why it took me so long to do her. Same with Godmother of Rock and Roll. She's been knocking around for a wee bit. But other more personal stuff had to be executed first, I suppose. And as I say, textiles leapfrog over each other. Mm. Obviously something just made me think, okay, now I need to execute this piece and get it out. And there was another one. I'm not too sure if I've done her justice. She is my ultimate, ultimate heroine. Her name is, Edmonia Wildfire Lewis.
Wow.
He was a stone carver.
Okay.
In the 1800s. She was a native American and African, and she started carving in America. She went to Rome to start to carry on carving to learn more, and she was in this artist colony in Rome, where there's a whole backstory, but she is my. That question people get asked, a person from history, who would you like to have for dinner? History. It's Edmonia. It's Edmonia.
Yeah.
She's the one I would want to sit down with a bottle of gin and a packet of crisps. And I just want to talk to her. So when I was in Italy last year doing this marble portrait, I was at one point. When I first arrived, I was a bit tearful because I don't know of any other black females who carve stone, marble, in this, I suppose, call it an academic, white academic, white historic style, who have gone to Italy to carve. Because I trained as an architectural stone carver, so I'm formally trained, so like her. And so I was just, she was on my mind a lot. So I've done a textile, but it's taken me all. I have done other textiles about her, but this one took. I don't know why it took me so long, but she was obviously bubbling for a long, long while. But I still don't think I've done her justice. I love her skirts. I've done little flames on her skirts, and she's holding a mallet, and she's got her little cap on and her little coat. She's standing next to a bust, So it works, but I'm not too sure.
There's a lot of gravity riding on this one.
I could do another one of her. But the thing is, I keep all my working tracings of every piece I've done, so I can technically do a copy, but it was never going to be the same. The textiles are never going to be the same, but but the image can be the same. So I've got that option.
So then the curious thing then, and like I say, this is a textile show. But obviously, the stone carving. Do you mostly do food when you're making your own?
My own pieces, yes, my own pieces. I have a sub. Well, I know the reason. My own is all things culinary, all things culinary,
right.
And sometimes it can be a slightly obscure link, but it all comes back. It started off. When did it start? I did my main piece for my show at where I trained at City and Guilds of London Art School. A very, very formal architectural stone carving course. Very, very formal. And you're trained to work in the trade. So your work is for buildings. My main piece for my show was this thing called a festoon of the fruits and vegetables fauna of the West Indies. It's a huge piece. So that's where I started to research food and, carve and what have you. Although I think saying that, even when I was at Wolverhampton, I knew I wanted to find, I wanted to learn more about stone carving. Because I knew what was bubbling even back then. Well, I wanted to be able to depict my own culture in this very formal, elitist, white medium. I wanted to see my own culture, my own stuff, my own. Mm-hmm. but it's turned out it turned out to be food, because food is a universal topic, yeah, a universal thing. So yes, so my own pieces in this. So I will be showing a few stone pieces, but my own personal pieces are food related. So I can do it in a very, very detailed way, showing every little, you know, crook and cranny and, you know, leaf and vein if I wanted to. But quite often I will just take an element of that style of carving and simplify it. So it's a simplified, sometimes distorted version of a beef tomato or a sweetheart cabbage, which I've recently done and sold. But then there's still that small element of historic carving involved. So there's an element. So food is a universal thing. And oh God, I'm really, really talking out of.
No. I love it. I love it. Keep going.
So what in my other, because I told you I used to be really involved in history, really loved history, but I wanted to do at one point another degree course in the anthropology of food, because I'm fascinated with how I've got lots of reference books on food and food and history, food through history and the anthropology of, and how, you know, for example, with Jamaica, how our eating habits in Jamaica and the Caribbean were influenced by, you know, how the Portuguese brought, the Portuguese were the first slave traders, and the Portuguese were the first to hit the islands, and they brought the salted fish. Because the sailors had salted fish on board, and so, mm-hmm. so the ackee and salt fish, that's where we get the salt fish. So it's a case, and this is the case with all cultures, you know, a lot of cultures. How even the eating habits, the eating times, what we use, the implements we use. I'm fascinated by all of that. The pots we use. A big Jewish contingency came to the West Indies, and so we're influenced by food from them and cooking implements by them. It's fascinating. So food is food and textiles and stone carving. God, what a mess! Jesus Christ.
There's a book that's called A Short History of the World According to Sheep by Sally Coulthard.
Oh, no, I've never seen that one.
No. But basically what it is, it's one of these other, like, looks at life and anthropologically, but how the sheep turns out to be one of the most important animals in history. Because, for instance, without sheep being able to produce wool, being able to produce strong fibres, like, the Vikings would have never made it across to the UK. It's one of these ones where throughout history there are certain historical references to sheep back in the Egyptian time and all of this sort of thing. And just this animal that you just kind of take for granted, but it turns out it's like one of the most magnificent, like, pieces of our societal history ever or something. And I kind of love that. That's exactly what that was making me think of. Or something like the fact that we used to have like 500 different types of pea the UK. But nobody ever really thinks about that now. It's just bonkers, really. When you're making the carvings, and obviously I guess some of that is just commercial carving, so you're making stuff that other people have asked you to do. Does the creative process for your carving art sit in a separate part of your brain to the creative process for your textile art? Do they come together? Is there going to be a point when they meet? Because you said that, like, you somewhat iconize. You make food and you simplify it to make it more translatable in the same way as you do with your figures. I wonder whether they're concurrent streams, do they merge?
As yet, no. No. Obviously, that's something that's come up on several occasions. I mean, I earn my living. I do the food pieces I do. I do again for myself to, you know, because I'm in Sainsbury's and I'm passing by the vegetable aisle and I'll see, I saw this sweetheart cabbage and I, for some reason I've never seen a sweetheart cabbage before. I thought, oh, that's really beautiful. Oh my God, you know, and I'm looking at, so I'm standing there comparing which sweetheart cabbage to pick up. And so I do those. I do a lot of the food stuff for myself and then people seem to buy them. But so I have been commissioned for one or two pieces, but I earn my living with my letter engraving. So that's but the food pieces I do more, you know, for myself, but people buy them. But having them emerge, the stone, and there's something bubbling. There's something bubbling, and I like the idea of wrapping stone with fabric, just like mummifying it. But I'm not going to force it. What happens quite often is because I now sometimes have to, because our shower here at home is shite. I end up wallowing in the bath. So I wallow in the bathtub. And I sometimes have to have a notepad beside me because quite often I get my ideas wallowing in the bathtub. And so I have to reach for the notepad. So, I have written down ideas, but I'm not ready to force that, the merging of the stone and the textiles as yet. When it comes, it'll come, and I'll jump out of the bath and, you know.
You'll have a eureka down the hallway.
Yeah. But something's bubbling, but I just don't know what yet. What I have done with stone, I have done several pieces. I've called it my monkey see, monkey do series. And I've done a series of bananas, and these bananas are in different types of stone. But I've done one where it's in marble. But I want to redo that one. It's in marble. It's one of my first ones, and I've inserted lots and lots of shards of glass and nails and pins, so the shards are just bursting out of this white banana. The thing behind that, oh sorry, we're talking about textiles, aren't we? Sorry. The monkey see, monkey do, that series of bananas came about because of, I've come across people who are surprised, taken aback that a black female carves in this seemingly white, historic, academic style. I should be doing, it's very, again, in this, I'm working in this very elitist medium. And so when I was training, I used to get it. The idea was that I, as a black female, couldn't possibly, have or develop the necessary aesthetic
just it would be beyond you, isn't it? You sound so daft when you try and say it out loud,
the aesthetic qualities. Yeah. Thank you. After that, I'll do so. I couldn't possibly develop the aesthetic qualities needed to carve this style of work. So I must be, you know, it's, you know, monkey see. I just copy, you know. But you know, you're trained at college, as where we were, to copy. That's the point of an artisan. But to copy for restoration and conservation work, so your piece goes back into a building and you carry on the tradition of the history of that building. So we are trained to copy, but the thinking was that I couldn't possibly know what I was doing or the history behind what I was doing. So hence the monkey see, monkey do thing. I saw the whole series of that. And there might be a textile bubble in there as well. But this is how my textiles start. I'm usually having a conversation with something, and then, something will, a kind of word will come up, and I'll just quickly write it down and I will develop.
I love it. It's reminding me of when you know your porridge is done, and because the bubbles start slowly coming to the surface. Yeah. They don't come like fizzy water. They just come to the top of that and they go, I'm ready. I can see that. I completely love the fact that you're saying, you know, you've got these ideas, but there's just no rush because there's plenty of other ones that are just getting in the way. That's clearly
philosophy. I've got so much in stone and in textile because I want to. I was watching the other day? I started watching this. Was it the prequel to Game of Thrones that's now on?
No, House of the Dragon.
Yeah, that. And it reminded me that I want to do this Bayeux tapestry type thing in my textbook. I want to do a really, really long piece. Well, there's so much I want to do. But yes.
Could it be like a Bayeux tapestry? You know, like a sort of New Orleans version of it or something?
Oh, yeah, there is that. I think I pronounced it wrong. Bayeux? Anyway.
Bayeux tapestry.
And I started to think of what story do I want to tell? Do I want to tell my story? Or women from history? Or mixture? Or just queens? So, yes, I'd love to do a really, really long... I need the space. I've got no space.
Can I ask a couple of dumb stonemasonry questions? How do you get it so smooth? Do you sand it?
To begin with, depending on what stone you're working with, you use a thing called a little fancy files called rifflers, right. And they're double ended. And they've got different shapes either end, which helps you get into the nooks and crannies. And so ideally you're skilled enough to get your surface to a good standard just with your hammer and chisel. But then you get to the riffler, or file, which, you know, again, smooth, and then it's sandpaper. So
right. And then how do you? Because I was thinking about this. Obviously, you're hitting with a hammer and a tool of some sort, so that's quite hard work on your hands. But at the same time, you've got to be able to feel what the stone is doing, right? The sort of connection with the stone, the tension of it.
Yeah, there is. There definitely is that. I think that's why I wasn't very good. I've tried. I admire wood carving immensely. I follow quite a few wood carvers on Instagram. It's a beautiful, beautiful medium. I wish I could, but for me, it's I've tried doing wood carving and it's not the same with stone. There's a sound to it. There's a ring and a bounce. The sound of the chisel hitting the stone, and the chisel can bounce, and it's rhythmic, and that's very therapeutic. If you rub your hand over a piece of wood, you're going to get splinters, as far as I'm concerned. But you can, you can feel the stone as you're going along, and how the light hits the stone. If you know you've got an area you need to work on a bit more, you just sort of tilt your head and see where you need to, you know, take a shave off a wee bit more. So, yes, it's a lovely medium. Yes, yes.
And then the other question I've got, and I've often thought this because I always joke about the fact that I love working in needlework because the postage is so cheap. Mm. What do you do when you do a really big, are you like really strong? Like, because the pieces, do you not sometimes do a piece and go, well, I'm never going to be able to move that because it weighs a quarter of a ton or something?
I don't do pieces. Well, if I'm commissioned, but as yet I've never done. Well, there was one statue. The criteria for the statue has changed now, so it's now gotten smaller. So it's now I will be able to execute it in my workshop, which is I'm much much happy about. But I was I've got a statue I'm going to be doing for this community gardens. Just up the road from King's Cross tube station, King's Cross train station, and that was going to be just a larger than life size figure in stone. I was very excited about doing this, but I did say, oh look, you know, they said, you know, what is the best scenario, Marcia, for you to do this? And if we find you a workshop where you could execute this, would you be able to do it? And I said, well, yes, if you find me a workshop with all the, there's lifting equipment. So that's how you move stone out.
Yeah.
Because I learnt the hard way at college at Wolverhampton Poly, because I had no tuition whatsoever, even though there was a tutor there. He didn't like me. So I was left to my own devices. There was a gantry, which is a big lifting piece of equipment, and I just learnt to use all the lifting equipment myself. So nice. Yes, you can move stone. If you've got the space and the equipment, you can move stone yourself. But yes, so but I so far most of the pieces I've done, I can manage myself. I don't like relying on other people. I hate relying on other people. I really hate it. Yeah. So if I can execute, if I can keep everything within my own control, stone wise, then I will. But sometimes you have to farm work out. I have done that. Even moving stone, I hate having to ask people to help me. But sometimes you just have to, you know. I'm not silly.
Can you tell by looking at a piece and be like, no, I won't be able to lift that one now?
Oh, yes, yes. But then still, just because of where I trained, you learnt to find ways of moving big blocks. There's ways of, you know, rocking a block and, you know, doing a kind of step motion until you get to the level, and then you shove it on, and there's rollers. There's all sorts of ways that, you know, you can, you know, move stuff. I say, yes, yes, I am strong, so I can lift a fair amount. But I don't do it anymore because, Jesus Christ, I'm getting old. That's what
I know. It's a daft question to ask. Yeah. It's just, I remember once going, I think it was to a Henry Moore exhibition, and look at some of the pieces and just going, you know, what if you just make art that's huge as standard, and you're just like, well, I've got to have a big studio.
I'm not one of those artists. I'm not just talking about stone. I'm talking about paintings or any medium. I'm not a big fan of big for the sake of big. At art college,
until the tapestry piece.
All my textiles are just happen to be more or less A3 size. A lot of them are A3 size, but now some of them, if they need to be bigger, then they're bigger. If they need to be bigger, but otherwise they're A3 size. But then that Bayeux tapestry one is just for the it's just all, I need to, because I need to do that. I would love to see that. But I don't just do big for the sake of big with my stone carving. I find that very irritating, you know. Painting has to be huge because the gallery wants it big. Or I used to call them big dick paintings. You know, I don't have time for that. Sometimes some paintings and work can be just as beautiful and just as difficult to execute. Small and just as beautiful. Yes.
Shout out to Karen Garfin, actually, there, who she's a needlework. She originally trained doing like needlework samplers for doll houses. All of her work is teeny, teeny, tiny, and it's amazing. So, yeah,
right. Your sound is sound.
Let's do the big questions now that we've talked about all of the art stuff, the really easy stuff. Let's go on to the hard questions of do you have a favorite band/album?
No,
good, okay. Let's talk about music.
I listen to music in the workshop and in the car, because it's an hour's drive to my workshop. I listen to music all the time. I used to listen, when I was carving, to the radio. I used to listen to Radio 4, because I used to like, you know, the documentaries and, you know, The Archers and, you know, The Woman's Hour and work. But I stopped listening. It was just getting on my nerves. So I listened to music. There isn't a single favorite album I have. In the car, there are some albums which get played for months. I'll tell you, the one I've gone back to, I can't believe I've gone back to her. I mean, I've worn out the CD. It's Janet Jackson. It's a Janet Jackson double album. It's compilation. I'm sorry. I know I should do something more, you know, bouncy, but it's Janet does the job. It gets me from A to B, you know.
Yeah.
And it's double album. And so, yeah, my music tastes are very, very, very Catholic. Okay. I've got the Arctic Monkeys. I think I've got nearly all the Arctic Monkeys CDs. But then I've got Simon and Garfunkel. I've got Macy Gray. I've got XTC. I'm looking at my Alexandra O'Neill. I've got Scar. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't have any favourite.
How do you feel, just going off on a tangent, how did you feel about the Arctic Monkeys when they went down the Tranquility Base casino?
No.
It's the same as my wife there. She's like, because the other album, AM, was so good. We saw them tour that one.
Yeah.
Such a banger. And then they've gone left field. But in fairness to them, they stayed on the left field. Do you know what I mean? So you're like, well, he's just obviously going in another direction. Yeah.
No, I didn't think that's funny.
Do you listen to different music doing textiles to doing carving? Or is it just anything goes, wherever you
feel? Anything goes. Sometimes... I tell you what I've started to do. And I've been doing it for quite a while now. When I was in my old studio, because sometimes I will take textiles to the stone studio, but I will clear, when I had a bigger space, I have clean boards, and I'll make sure that day is a clean day, and the styles stay. All fabric, nothing touches the floor.
No dust.
Nothing goes, but I listen to podcasts and when I'm doing textiles. And as a matter of fact, I started, so I hadn't been listening to yours, but I started to listen to yours when I was stretching my fabrics. And I was quite enjoying them. I thought, you know, because I think I have to download, because I get really shit internet connection in my workshop, so I have to download them. But there was one. I actually wrote, because I was actually taking notes from what she said. Cass Holmes.
Yeah.
Yes, I thought she was, because she was talking about, you know, about, and I thought, because I wrote it down, about art built on failure and burning your work. I thought, I love the idea of burning my work, you know, getting rid of the old stuff. So, but anyway, so sorry, I'm off track.
No.
I don't listen to anything different that much, but when I'm textiling, I tend to do more podcasts now. So,
Oh, well, I feel very honoured to be part of that assembly. Yeah, talking to Kaz as well. Kaz really thrives in that kind of the fearless space, because she's kind of like, you know, uses found objects, all that kind of stuff. She's very much just like, I'm just going for it. And, you know, not too much editing. And I think that's really
cool. Yeah, I liked that. I liked brave. That. Yeah, there was another, what was the other? She was one of your early podcasts. She did, her favourite piece was the Paul McCartney one with...
Jane Sanders, Stitching in the Kitchen.
She was a very good one. I enjoyed, but yeah.
Super charismatic. Yeah. Talked to her for days. Cool. Okay, right. Now, do you have a favourite book, or what was the last good book you read, depending on which one works better?
It's not a favourite book.
Okay.
It's a volume. I love this book. It's the Image of the Black in Western Art. There's 10 volumes of it. And it's Harvard University Press. And it's done by David Bindman and Henry Louis Gates Jr. 10 volumes. It's as it says, the Image of the Black, depicted by whites, you know, and people from history, but it goes from the pharaohs and the fall of the Roman Empire, and it goes through to early Christian era, the American Revolution, and then it goes finishes on the 20th century and the rise of the Black artist. So it covers 10 volumes. And I've been collecting those for donkey's years. I mean, they're big volumes. Yeah. I first came across one volume at Wolverhampton Poly in the 80s. And I didn't know anything about Black art. I hadn't seen Black art. I didn't know anything about Black artists. I'd never seen any imagery of Black people in art. And there was this one volume, and I thought, holy shit, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Really? This one volume they had. And obviously, I think I took photocopies from it, and then that bubbled. Then I came across more volumes. I was working as an apprentice in San Francisco, a stone carving apprentice, during my summer holidays while I was training. And I got hold of more volumes. I thought, oh my God. I just spent a fortune on photocopying in colour. So again, years and years later, did I buy my first volume? But anyway, subsequently, my then boyfriend, now husband, has over years been buying me, because they're not cheap, right. Buying me a volume every now and again. And I forget, you know, so I've got all 10 volumes now, but they are just so beautiful. There's a wealth of imagery in there that it's take a lifetime to look at properly. And the information, so there's that. That is my... It is a desert island disc thing. I would take I'll take those volumes with me. But then in terms of literature, it came up, and I thought, I don't know why I love this book so much. I've read it twice, and I think I've seen two adaptations, the BBC adaptation, The Mayor of Casterbridge by Thomas Hardy. What's that about? I was thinking about it, I think, you know what, I could read that again for a third time. What is it about the story that I love so much? So those are my, I've got another
book related question then, and I hope you don't mind me asking this.
Okay.
Imagine that I'm a white man who is doing his best to be aware of cultural issues.
Okay.
What's the best black history book do you think I ought to read? One that's maybe not too heavy, but is there a good one that will just help me keep my perspectives broad?
Where would I start?
Of course, I've got two young children, and we've got a couple of books. There's one about, is it Timelines of Black History, something like that, which is a really useful one for actually spelling things out.
Okay, I've got one here. Okay, where would you start? I'm looking at, you could start with, I've got one looking at the Black Victorians, because it was with the Victorians that, because before then, I'm looking at another one called Black Tudors. Another textile piece I did, which again sparked up a whole story, a really lovely conversation, which actually, sorry, I'm really jumping around.
Go on.
A textile I did sparked off another textile I did, which is now going to be the main textile for this. If not the tree, then check your roots. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I did a textile piece called "Since the Romans," because I'm getting back on track. Black people have been in England since the Romans. We've been here. We came with the Romans. We came as soldiers. We also came as slaves. There were white slaves. There were black slaves, but there were also black soldiers, and who led troops. We've been here. And so we were part and parcel of the English history, the English, the fabric. And so I've got one here called Black Tudors. We were in court. Musicians, but as ladies' maids and what have you. But it was with the Victorians. Yeah, I'm getting back on track.
Mm-hmm.
It was with the Victorians that there was a sea change. There was the whole thing of separating us from. We became the other.
Hmm.
With the measuring of the skulls and the separating of. Because the blacks and working class were rubbing along together, but then at some point, science kicked in, and it was deemed useful to turn us into the other and separate us, and we became, outsiders. Things were never very easy, but because at one point Queen Elizabeth I said, she made this proclamation that, she wanted that there were too many black people running around. So we were there in numbers.
Yeah.
But there were too many black people running. But we were there in numbers. So it was Victoria. So basically I would have to get back to you.
That's okay. You can send me a reading list later.
Yeah.
But no, because that's the thing. Like when you were saying about those volumes of the books as well, there's a documentary series I've referenced before that's called The Century of the Self by Adam Curtis. And it talks about how we at this stage in time are the product of 120 years of psychological based marketing.
Yeah.
Something like that, needs and wants and all of those sorts of things. And I'm always conscious of the stories we're told. I'm a man doing cross stitch, whatever the stories are. And as you rightly say, there will have been stories that have diverted the way white society looks at black society, looks at any other kind of society. And it's all just tales we're told, usually for some political reason somewhere down the line. So it's interesting to try and dial back and get to the points before that. That book of the art, I would imagine when you go back further, you start to get a truer picture of art. And then I'd imagine at some point it gets obfuscated by marketing or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, there's a beautiful image. I think it's on the cover. I think it's actually on the cover of one of my volumes. This this black knight. He's in armor. He's in armor. It's beautiful. I say it's just, that's like the whole history thing just came. So much is untold. So much is forgotten. How much of a, it's not even a case of contribution. We were part and parcel, or we have been. We are part and parcel of the history of the country. And it's just been useful because of colonization to forget that. But anyway, don't get me started. Anyway,
No. That's an entirely another podcast series we'll do in 2025.
Jesus Christ, yeah.
So you mentioned House of Dragon. Do you have a favourite TV show? Was that the last good thing you watched?
Oh, no. Well, I'm getting back.
Is it a good thing?
I was kind of reluctant to get back into it. My husband was sort of, badgering me. Oh, he's doing this. And I thought, okay, I'll give it another go. So, but, and that's it. And the opening credit is this, this tapestry being. I've just seen the first one, and it's, I thought, okay, I'll watch it. But, in terms of, I'm trying to see what, I am one for the American dramas, one of my favourites. Oh, Jesus Christ, I love it so much. The Good Fight.
Okay.
Yeah. It started off with The Good Wife, and then the spin-off was The Good Fight, and it's this law firm of black lawyers and the ins and outs and what have you, and that was fabulous. But I say I have very trashy tastes, but
that's okay. You can't be excellent, exemplary in every direction.
I'm trashy.
I think I heard something about The Good Fight about how, like, the two lead actresses, by the time they got to the last series, really did not like each other, and it's almost like if you watch the final episode of it, they're not in the same room ever.
Oh, I think that's the same shot. Whatever. I think I heard that with the Good Wife. It was The Good Wife.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
Right.
I heard that. And then, but the spin-off is different. But
maybe that's why the spin-off happened then.
Yeah, The Good Fight. Yes, I heard that the two leads or two lead actresses, yes, fell out. I like trash TV.
That's fine. Last question then: is there an interesting fact that not a lot of people know about Marcia Bennett Mayall?
I am on the facade of Westminster Abbey.
Wow.
My tutor, John Roberts, he's dead now, unfortunately. He was one of several master carvers who was employed to carve what they call the modern martyrs, and he got to do, I think he did two of them, I think it was about 10 of them, 10 or 12 of them, above the main facade of Westminster Abbey. So whenever they do their, like, the coronation, and what have you, I think, oh, there I am. So I am what's her name? Manche. I always pronounce her name Manche Masimola. She was an African, a young African woman who was stoned to death by her parents because she would not give up her Christian faith. Right. I know, blimey, heavy, right? I can't remember what date this was. I didn't write that down. There was no pictures of her. There's no imagery of her whatsoever. So my tutor, I was still a student back then. I think I was a third year student when John got the commission, and he asked me if I would sit for. For this piece. Mm-hmm. Back then I had cheekbones and, I had short hair, so I've actually got a copy of his clay model as you know, as a keepsake. But he based it on me. So yeah, I'm on the facade of Westminster Abbey, basically.
Love that. That's a corker. That's marvellous. Hey Marcia, thanks for having an Eel Exchange with me.
Thank you very much. Thoroughly enjoyed it, Jim. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NEEDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.